This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 1979, TireRack.com has been helping people find the right tires for how, what, and where they drive. They sell only the best, like the full line of Bridgestone tires. Test results, ratings, and reviews are there to assist. Or try the Tire Decision Guide to get a personalized tire recommendation. Tires ship fast and free to you or one of over 10,000 recommended installers. In many areas, they offer mobile tire installation that comes to your home or office. Shop Bridgestone Tires at TireRack.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Tuilan Liu. This is the Buddhist Studies Podcast. Welcome and thank you so much for joining us today. In today's program, we will be speaking with Dr. Ruth Gamble. Ruth is an environmental and cultural historian of Tibet, the Himalaya, and Asia. She's currently a lecturer at La Trobe University in Australia. Today, Ruth and I will talk about her new book, The Third Karmapa Rangchung Dorje, Master of Mahamudra. This book came out with Shambhala Publications recently in 2020. Ruth is also the author of another book, Reincarnation in Tibetan Buddhism, The Third Karmapa and the Invention of a Tradition. And the second book, this book came out with Oxford University in 2018, 2 years ago. So welcome to the program, Ruth.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you here. So first of all, I wanted to congratulate you on the publication of another fantastic book. And Ruth, I have to tell you this. As soon as I picked up the book, I literally could not put it down until I finished it. It's so well-researched and beautifully written, and I can easily imagine how different readers could enjoy and appreciate this book for different reasons. And to those of you who are listening to this podcast right now, whether you are interested in Buddhism, Tibet, poetry, or life stories in general, you will not be disappointed when you open this book. So without further ado, Ruth, can you talk about what brought you to the field to write about Tibet?
Wow, you think that's an easy question. Okay, it was kind of a long journey. And I mean, not quite as long as the journeys that Rangchung Dorje went on in his life. But so I was interested in meditation as a teenage skateboarder. And I actually talked about this in the beginning of the prologue to the book. And going to do meditation while skateboarding. I used to skate to meditation class, and then through going to those classes, I ended up going to the mountains when I was still a teenager, which is like 3 years ago. When I got there, I was just blown away by the mountains. I remember the time that I first saw these mountains in the sky. So I was kept being drawn back to the place as well as the stories. I left school, and because I was the first person in my family to go to university, that's Australian for university, I had to pick a job, a degree with a job in the title. So I studied journalism, but I was a really bad journalist, and did that for a few years. But then I got a scholarship to go and study Tibetan in India. So I went and studied Tibetan there. I worked as an interpreter, then did another degree in Asian studies, which I liked better than journalism, then did a PhD, working on this material on the life stories and poems of the third Karmapa Rangchung Dorje.
Okay, that sounds like a very long journey.
It is. I left out this interlude snowboarding, so I cut it short. Yeah.
Okay, so this new book is about the life story and writings of a remarkable Tibetan, the third Karmapa Rangchung Dorje. This is indeed your second book about him. So can you talk about who this person is and what made you so interested in writing about him? So basically, how did you begin working on this particular project?
So I actually stumbled across Rangjin Dorje, almost literally, because I did my honors thesis, which is like a master's, on the poems of Milarepa, and I was really interested in this kind of the genre of lu or gur songs in the Tibetan tradition and the associated with the Doha in the Indic tradition. And I wanted to write a thesis on Milarepa, a PhD thesis, and someone had already done that. All right. So I had to kind of, I was a bit stuck, and someone handed me, it was back in the day, right? So they handed me a CD with the collected works of Rangjin Dorje on it. And I thought, oh, this is worth a look. And then I found this massive collection of his songs, of these gur on this CD. There were so many. And I was like, I didn't know. It was like finding a treasure that there's this whole collection. And then as I was working my way through his collected works, I also found these two autobiographies by him of different sections of his life. And then I was completely intrigued, this combination of personal stories and then very personal songs, like very personal songs, that I really felt like I got a sense of this person. So I became totally fascinated with his life, his songs, and they kind of complemented each other, because the life story set out the narrative but did it in a kind of conventional way. But then the songs really took you into his experiences and feelings as he moved through the world. So, yeah, it was a very interesting combination. And I should say, on top of that, I think his life story in itself really resonated with me, because he was really an outsider. He grew up really outside the main kind of power structures within Tibet. He traveled around. He was really interested in the environment. And he went so far. So during his lifetime, starting off as a kind of almost outcast on the edges of the Tibetan plateau, and ending up his life as the guru to the last Mongol emperor, right? That's the biggest empire in world history, contiguous empire in world history. And he was right there at the center of it. So that life story is completely amazing to me. Yeah.
So your journey with this project actually started with an unexpected encounter.
It did. And,
okay. So, you know, this person, Rangjin Dorje, he also carries this title, the third Kamaba. And yeah. For our listeners who might be less familiar with this tradition, can you explain what does that mean? Where did he get that title? What does that title mean?
Right. So he didn't. The idea of him being the third Kamapa is something that kind of evolved through his storytelling and his identity throughout his life. So the Kamapas are a series of reincarnate gurus or teachers in the Tibetan tradition. That are kind of, when people tell their story, it goes all the way back to the 11th century, and there's two competing candidates for the 17th Kamapa at the moment living today. So it's a very long history. And these were the first people that they kind of lined up in a row and said, this person is the reincarnation of this person, is reincarnation of this person. Other examples of a reincarnate system, the most famous one is, of course, the Dalai Lamas, and we're now up to the 14th Dalai Lama. So when I was reading his, when I started reading his life story, I came with this preconception that his life had followed the same pattern as all the other Kamapas, in that he was, and all the other members, all the other reincarnates, for that matter, who are discovered or given the title as young children, trained in the tradition. Then take on other students who are other reincarnate lineages, people from other reincarnate lineages, and then pass away, and then their students find them, and then the passage continues. But what I discovered reading Rangjin Dorje's work is that during his lifetime, part of his personal project is to establish himself as a Kamapa. Right? And he doesn't always call himself the third Kamapa. He sees himself as being the reincarnation of the second, what we now know as the second Kamapa, who was kind of the first person to be called the Kamapa, because his name was Karma Pakshi and he was from a monastery called Karma Gumpa. So he gets called Kamapa, the person of karma. And then that Kamapa saw himself as a reincarnation of another Buddhist teacher, Thusum Khyentpa. So Rangjin Dorje was establishing himself as the third in a line. And there'd been people who'd seen themselves as the reincarnation of someone else before, but that idea of being third in a line really kind of cemented the idea that this would keep happening. And he sets about setting up all of the kind of literary, but also architectural, establishes monasteries and sets up all of the kind of infrastructure, so the cultural and social infrastructure for that tradition to continue past his lifetime.
Okay, so this sounds like a really interesting institution. Can you perhaps maybe elaborate further on the history of the reincarnation institution to help us understand whether is this a particular institution that is unique in Tibetan Buddhism, or is it something that has been widely used and practiced across different religious Buddhist communities in Asia?
So the idea of reincarnation isn't unique to the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. But having this idea of institutionalized reincarnates, one who comes after the other, and are usually associated, that was the other thing I found in my research for the first book, they're usually associated with specific sites, mostly monasteries, but sometimes communities, right, that they return back to, and they become like the person who's the owner or the person associated with that place. And so like the Dalai Lamas are associated with the Potala in Lhasa, the Kamapas were associated with three monasteries, Tsopo Monastery, Thamagon and Neti, which they lost basically in southern Kham. So they're associated with this monastery. They would keep returning to that monastery. That's a new institution. What we're talking about with Kamapas establishing it, returning to this monastery, being the holder of the lineage in that monastery is new. But so it's kind of like an adaptation of a wider belief and understanding of reincarnation rather than something completely new. And particularly the Kamapa and the people that were promoting this idea of reincarnates went to a lot of effort to show that it had precedence, because they're not interested in being necessarily innovative, right? So they were drawing on precedence, but this was definitely a development that was unique to Tibet at that time. But you couldn't say that it's unique still to Tibet, because the idea of having reincarnates was exported later to Mongolia, and particularly Mongolia's got very strong monastic institutions, but also Bhutan, northern Nepal, Ladakh. It got exported to lots of places.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. We also oftentimes hear another term, which is rebirth, that is a very popular concept embedded in Buddhism. So is the reincarnation institution connected to rebirth, and how are these two related? Are they interchangeable, or are they the same or not?
It depends what you're saying, because we're using English terms here, right? So I don't know. English terms are kind of floating signifiers in this context. You can kind of blend them up and move them around and use them however you want. And I mean, I guess that's kind of what happened in the Tibetan tradition as well, but they were kind of more specific about the terms that they were using. So the term that's mostly used to describe those who are recognized as reincarnates within these institutional frameworks now in the Tibetan tradition is the word trupu, right? But that's actually a Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit term nirmanakaya, which means the bodily form of the Buddha. But during the Kamapa's term, he doesn't really use that term to describe people who are the reincarnates of or rebirths of other people. He uses the term yangsi or yangwekyepa, so one who becomes again or one who is born again, right? And he uses the word tuku to actually talk about his guru or genpa. Right, so he sees his guru as a Buddha. So what we have happening over the centuries, really, or during his lifetime and lifetimes of the fourth and maybe fifth Kamapas, is this merging of the idea of a guru being a manifestation of a Buddha, therefore a nirmanakaya, therefore a tuku, and the idea of reincarnation as more and more people were recognized as reincarnations, and the idea of being a reincarnate became merged with the idea of being a guru.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent.
Does that make sense? that's
absolutely
really complicated, weird, like 300 years of history in 23 seconds. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay, so with those background information in hand, we can now move on to talk about the details of your book. Mm-hmm. You mentioned in this book that one unique feature of the third Gamaba's autobiographical writing is that in these autobiographies, he oftentimes included a depiction of some interlife journey.
Yeah.
That term is really interesting itself. So what is an interlife journey? Can you help us understand that?
Right. So in my, you know, when I found this, the CD with all of these Sumbum, his collected works on it, there was a series of autobiographies. And one of them was my time from when I was young to when I was old. And another section is writing from when he's in Xanadu or in the Mongolian court. But there's another part of his, another section of his biography, which said my journey between lives and then my previous lives. Which is unusual in most people's biographies. So, and these were really fascinating. So one of them, and they seem to me to be part of his articulating his continued identity as a Kamapa with a connection to the, as the third Kamapa with a connection to the second Kamapa, Gamabakshi. So one of them describes the one where he talks about all his past lives he goes through and talks about how he was this Gamabakshi, the second Kamapa, how it was Tusen Kempa, the first Kamapa, and then goes all the way back through other kind of luminaries in Tibetan meditation history and also to India and so on. And then he writes another section, which is how I got from being Gamabakshi to being the recognized as Rangchen Dorje, the, so between the second and third Kamapas. And in this he talks about how he remembers passing away. And it's a bit, and his consciousness, because so in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they have this idea that your consciousness dissolves, your sensory consciousnesses dissolve in your body, and eventually your most subtle consciousness leaves the body, and then the kind of through habituation takes on another form. So he describes this process, but then he describes how he dissolved. So there's two different sections to it, and different kind of parts to it that seem like they're a kind of a cobbled together tradition in a way of all that he had to build between all the different stories that he could have told. It seems to have told one when he was a kid that was that went one way, and then had a more subtle version as he grew up and kind of melded them together. But there's one part of the story where he attempts to reincarnate in a deceased body and that doesn't work, and then he goes up into the into heaven, into a pure realm, and he's meditating. And then these earth deities, who I have to say are kind of my favorite people from this story. I just love these earth deities from the who are kind of the protectors of the Tibetan plateau. And I just love this idea that these women from all around the plateau who are like, oh, we need him to come down and help us out again. So they go up into the heavens and start an argument with him. And he says to them, would you just go away? He's like arguing back to these earth deities. So it's like Mother Earth rises up and says, come on, we need your help. And he's like, oh, you're just tripping. Leave me alone. So they have this back and forth between them, and he eventually agrees to descend back into Earth. And he does this into the, like through a kind of symbolic version of his parents' bodies as being kind of melded with the environment in which they were living, and he follows a rainbow and comes back down into a human form.
Okay.
It's pretty cool. It's very like sci-fi and like, I don't know, I'm really interested in kind of ecological literature, and it really reminded me of this, a lot of kind of, it should be, yeah, someone could do a film of that, not me, but someone could, yeah.
All of this sounds really cool. And you know, we just celebrated the Halloween about 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, yeah, here in the United States. And I have to mention this one for our audience. So in one of the, Rangchen Dorje's description of this interlife journey, he described how his predecessor, the second Kamaba, had actually became a zombie or a rising corpse. Can you tell us more about that story? Because I'm sure there will be people who are really interested in learning the details of that.
So that's part of this kind of interlife tradition, right? So there's this story that, and it shows you how the idea of the reincarnation tradition and the being reborn tradition was melded with other types of consciousness control within the Buddhist meditation, the Tibetan Buddhist meditation tradition. So there was this idea that came from the stories of Marpa, who was a predecessor, that really good meditators could send their consciousness out of their body when they knew that they were going to die and find another consciousness. And so there's this idea that a tradition came from India to Tibet because an Indian sage sent his consciousness out and then traveled to Tibet. And there's also another tradition that Marpa's son sent his consciousness in a pigeon that then flew to India and then entered a corpse and became known as the Pigeon Prince, right? So he body hopped, yeah? But then, so Karmapakshi decides that he's not quite ready to finish his work as the Karmapas when he dies. So he sends his consciousness out looking for a body. Yeah, and he's floating around, it describes him floating around the Tsurpu area around where the monastery is in the Derlong Valley looking for a body. And he sees a young boy who has been about to be cremated by their parents because they've passed away. So it's just like an empty body. And he jumps into the body and reanimates it and jumps up. But this completely freaks the parents out, who are like, ah, because there's a Tibetan tradition of zombies, really, or zholang, which means corpse uprising, like bodies that stand up, right? And so they think that they don't realize that this is a reincarnating super meditator. They think it's a zombie, a zholang. So in his story, he says that he thinks that they stabbed him in the eyes. And that he then goes blind and can't see, and he thinks it's going to be really tough to be a blind meditator if I've got to convince everyone I've been reborn. So this isn't going to work. So he leaves the body again. Yeah. But later he goes back to visit the people whose child's body he has inhabited. And there's one version of the story that says, oh no, we just threw sand in your eyes so that you would lie down again. So there's different versions of the story and different perceptions of what had happened. But yeah, so he became a zombie, then that didn't work. And that's when he decides, okay, I'll have to go through the whole process of birth and so on again. Yeah. And make the journey between lives. Yeah.
This is a fantastic story. I think at least one thing it can do to us is like, maybe next time we have an encounter with a zombie or some kind of spirit, we should treat them really nicely because they could be.
Think about this. Yeah.
Yeah, because they could be the reincarnations.
I love there's a story about one of the teachers, Chattu Rinpoche, was one of the Dalai Lama's teachers who lived behind Dharamsala, and he met a Christian, and Thomas Merton came up to see him, and he said, I really wanted to meet you because I heard about this Christianity, and it seems like you guys had a Rola, a zombie that stood up after 3 days, and then we usually make them lie down again, but you all started a big religion around them. That always cracked me up. Yeah. it's different perceptions of this interaction between consciousness and bodies I found really fascinating in this whole thing. It's really a really key idea that flows the whole way through the stories.
So many of us have heard about, you know, this Tibetan term known as bardu, or the intermediate state. It's basically describing the period of time when a person has, you know, just died, you know, from that period of time to the time when the person is ready to be reborn. So the interlife journeys that Rangchung Dorje has described in his biography seems to be different from that intermediate state. So can you tell us, you know, are these interlife journeys common in autobiography writings produced by Tibetan writers from his time, or he was like, you know, a really unique person, like he was the only one who has included stories like this in his autobiographies?
So there's two different things happening there in your question, Soylan, if you don't mind me breaking them down, right? So most of the way that the bardo is described in the broader tradition outside of kind of Tibetan experiences of it, or Tibetan meditators, I should say, experience of it, is through the bardo turjal, or like a liberation on hearing in the bardo, which is a specific text from a specific tradition that describes like 49 days of experiences that one could have if they were doing certain meditations, right? So that's a very specific regimented form of the pardo, right? But everybody, according to the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, passes through in between stages. And they even talk about this idea of there being multiple pardos. I kept remembering I kept thinking last year that I was stuck in a phone pardo because I'd lost one and I wasn't going to buy a new one. I was like, oh my God, I'm in between phones and it's become a new type of pardo. But there's like but there's always these intermediate spaces for everyone. And it doesn't have to be that ritualized form that is associated with the Bardo Turdrul. I can't speak Tibetan at the moment. Bardo Turdrul. Anyway, there isn't that many people that write about the journey between the two lives, given that. Even everyone's supposed to experience that, but that idea of being conscious through the intermediary stage is supposed to be only associated with really higher level beings. Yeah, so there aren't many people who claim that consciousness to be able to be aware through that whole space. And there's also this, like, later traditions kind of said that if you are conscious, you should send yourself to a pure realm. Why would you come back? You know, so that's like part of the story of Ranjan Dorji's interlife experience as well. So there aren't that many stories of that experience, but there are some. There's a story about Tsongkhapa, for example, the going into the Bardo after, but that's not kind of like a post-life story about how he went and did tantric meditations after he left the body. So there are some stories. They're just not heaps. Yeah. But does that make sense? Like, yeah. But there's, I think that there's a kind of a fetishization about the idea of the Bardo in not so much academia, but like Western traditions where it's being linked to one text and one thing, and it's very other and very exotic, right? So that was my example of phone Bardo, because I was like, it's something that happens in little ways throughout our lives, and then in between lives, and then in between worlds. It kind of has all of these different forms in the broader Tibetan tradition, I'd say. Yeah.
So to some extent, can we say that this very intimate personal account of this interlife experiences that has been described by Ranjan Dorje makes this interlife journeys very special, at least in his writings, right?
Whether you're making a delicious family meal or a post-workout snack, choose the farm-fresh taste of Eggland's Best Eggs. Only Eggland's Best Hens are fed their proprietary all-vegetarian feed. That's what makes their eggs more nutritious. With 10 times more vitamin E, 25% less saturated fat, and 6 times more vitamin D compared to ordinary eggs. Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com to learn more.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finally, sunscreen worthy of your skin. Sol de Janeiro's new Rio Radiance SPF 50 collection, where glowing hydration meets sun protection in a beachy and nostalgic set. Confidently embrace your glow with lightweight 100% mineral SPF body lotion, refreshing SPF body spray, and shimmering SPF body oil. Receive 10% off on your first order on soldejaneiro.com, plus free shipping with the code SPOTIFY10.
I think it's very special, yeah, definitely. And it was about his identity, though. Mm-hmm. It's rare, right? Mm-hmm. That description, and it depends on a certain self understanding of the leap from one life to the other. But the other thing with what he's saying here is not just I remember passing through lives, but that memory gives me a connection to this person and establishes my identity. So it was really important to him as well as being very special. Yeah.
And speaking of identities, you mentioned multiple times in your book that Ranjan Dorje was actually born into a very poor Tibetan family. And when he was found and identified and recognized as the reincarnation or as the third Paramaba, Karmapa, there was basically a huge contrast or gap between his biological family and the new social context in which he's now placed in. So I was wondering maybe like, could the inclusion of this this very unique and very special interlife journeys, they were included there, you know, as one way for him to negotiate between the different powers that he had to navigate through once he was recognized as the third Karmapa. Could that be a possibility?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And it was kind of, you know, this, like all of these stories, his stories were kind of his currency. I don't want to be too crude, right? But it was kind of like, there's an amazing another story from his biographies, or no, it's actually from a biography of him, of his dad, who was seems to have been quite a committed meditator, but also maybe liked to drink, and took his son into town and was like, my son's the third come up, and got really drunk and told everybody in the town, and then the son's asked to kind of prove that he is. So it's almost like a family, they've got this, the family's like, this is our special kid, he's a bit of a child prodigy, and this is his story. So it becomes like a kind of literary or a storytelling currency that enables him to move from this kind of outsiders, displaced world into the centers of power, religious and political power in and economic power in the Tibetan Plateau at that time. Yeah, very much so.
And I think another aspect of his personal struggle with his identity is also reflected in a few things that you've already noticed in your book. So basically you said, we don't even know, we only know him as Rangjung Dorje. We don't even know what his, you know, personal name was when he was born. And after he has arrived at the monastery, he treated one of his teacher as a father teacher person.
Gempa.
He rarely mentioned his family. How should we, you know, interpret that?
Yeah, I think, there's different elements to it. One of them is something that you would know about, that idea of like renunciation and the monastic tradition, becoming part of the monastic tradition. And he took the vow, he seems to have taken the vows of a monk very seriously, right? So there is that idea of going forth from your family. Then there's the other thing is that, I don't know, I don't have proof for this, but I have a feeling that his parents just couldn't afford to keep him. That there was an element of that as well. Like they were traveling around, like I plotted where they traveled with this little baby, and they were traveling massive distances. And I know that people from that region are tough, but that I was imagining this woman carrying this tiny baby, all of these different distances in the first few years of his life, they were really doing it hard. So he went from a life of real hardship to being given as a child into the care of this great Ogyempa who'd traveled around the whole world and was and whipped the bum, am I allowed to say that, whipped the bottom of an imperial envoy, right? So Ogyempa was like a force of nature. So to be taken into that world, I think, was a real it really became his world, and he was really formed by those experiences with Ogyempa. There's one mention at one point that he maybe was helping one cousin at one point. So there is some kind of link with his family, but nowhere near. Like the second Karmapa's family is so intrinsic to his story and was running Tsurpul Monastery and were very powerful. So they, like the disjunct between how the second Karmapa's family worked and how Rangjung Dorje's family worked is quite, is quite clear and quite, there's a very, very different worlds into which they've been born and different life circumstances. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's very not according to the Tibetan tradition, right, where there's a real emphasis on inheritance and family links and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I asked you the question in the first place because as far as I can remember, in the autobiographies of many of the reincarnations in the Tibetan tradition, oftentimes they would describe in very, with a lot of detail about, you know, who the parents are and the circumstances, on the days in which they were born. So there will be a lot of detailed recordings. However, these details that were oftentimes included in the biographies or autobiographies of other reincarnations are completely absent in those writings. By
there's a story of when he was born and recognized the moon, so he's marked as a special child, but he is on the roof of a distant relative's house, born outside because these parents have nowhere to go. So that kind of gives you a sense of, really someone coming from the margins into the power centers through his recognition by Ogyempa as the third Karmapa. Yeah.
And a follow-up question is that, do you think, you know, he's... the circumstance in his biological family, could that have also contributed to the difficulties that he had, you know, he later encountered? Because in the book, you mentioned that, you know, after his ordination, he traveled to, you know, many different monasteries. And even when he visited the three monasteries affiliated with the Kamaba tradition, sometimes people let him in, but didn't really show much hospitality. And, you know, at one time, when he visited one of the three monasteries belonging to the Kama Kagyupa tradition, he was not even let in. Do you think
he walked up to it and then he's walking away? He's like, what happened? Yeah. Yes and no. In some ways, I think the fact that he came from this really, the fringes of society, meant that he could be recognized as a reincarnate or a rebirth. No, so I'd say at that stage, recognized as Gamapakshi's rebirth, because that whole kind of reincarnation infrastructure wasn't there. But he could be recognized as a rebirth without threatening the power of the of Gamapakshi's family and their hold on the lineage and the lands and the, so on associated with the with Serpu Monastery and Kamagun Monastery. Yeah, he could be in that space just as a reincarnate. There wasn't that sense at this time that, like, you know how we see these, I mean, you see the traditions now of reincarnates coming back and occupying the throne, taking on all of the power, and then, and sometimes like masses of money and stuff, right? Or at least land and influence. That, I don't think that was there. I think he would kind of came on as an adjunct, as like another spiritual practitioner who happened to have, did you like the college reference there? He came on as kind of a, he was like an adjunct to the monastery as opposed to being a tenured professor. Yes, that's what's going on there. So he was a, he lived near the monastery. He had associations with it. They cared for him, but he didn't automatically become the abbot. And it really wasn't until the family lineage of Gamapakshi and Rangjin Dorji blended years later. And now I've got in my head that it's the fifth Kamapa, but I'm having a bit of a blank, fifth or sixth, that that you got that the kind of coming together of the abbot traditions associated with the Gamakagyu monasteries and the Kamapa lineage. Yeah. He finally got tenure three births later.
I really like your comparison of his circumstance with the academia world. In particular, I love this term, you know, this adjunct religious leader of the Kamagaki tradition. That's genius. Okay. So one of my personal favorite moments in this book is the moment when you comment on the ending of Rangjung Dorje's life. And I'm just going to quote you directly. So in the book, he wrote, "If you read his life story as a singularity, the ending is rather sad. As the dislike he had for Xanadu suggests, he had become increasingly captive to the wishes of its secular rulers. The young monk from a poor background acquired an education and pursued the religious path only to die a virtual prisoner in a faraway land. Contrarily, if you read his life story as one webisode in a multi-life tale, his death in Xanadu and rebirth in Kongbo is a great escape." I was totally enchanted by the second interpretation. And it's, you know, the complete opposite of the sad ending, this, you know, the interpretation that you can get from the first one. So I'm just curious, is this second interpretation, like this alternative reading, your own understanding, your own analysis, or is it an interpretation that you have found to have been circulating among Tibetans who have followed him in his time?
It's definitely in the Tibetan texts, that idea that he escaped. Yeah, his so that was, and it's part of this kind of tension. So I should say that the Rangjin Dorji was living in monasteries and became more sort of monasteries and hermitages around Tibet. It becomes more and more famous. And then there's like a power shift with the Mongols, who used to be very closely connected to the Sakya tradition in Tibet. They're looking for another power source in Tibet. So they look to come to Rangjin Dorji and they bring him to the court, where he kind of acts as a local miracle maker for them in the Mongol court, and a teacher to the to the emperor, but he wants to leave and go back to Tibet, and he manages to go once, and then they drag him back again, and he's stuck in Xanadu, and he keeps saying, "I hate it here, I don't like it, you know, come, it's not, everyone else says it's an amazing place to be, he just doesn't like it." And so then he says to the emperor, "If you don't let me go, I'll find another way." And then he dies and is reborn in Gongpo. He says he wants to go back to the place where he was doing meditating in southern Tibet, and they say you can't go back, and he's like, "Well, I'm going to die and go back." Right? It's very explicit in the story. And I think it goes to this alternate reading of lots of Tibetan history, I think, where there is this constant kind of shifting dynamic between the power of the religious authorities that are working in multi-life spaces and those who are working in secular this life spaces. Because it's like, what can you do? You know, if someone's not afraid of death, if someone's operating in a world beyond what you are able to control, how do you control them? And so it's definitely part of this idea that this is his way of playing a power game against the emperor. You may be in control of this entire empire, but I can slip past you into another world and then come back. It's very explicit. Yeah. It's cool too. Hey, I like it. Yeah.
And it's a very beautiful interpretation, and that completely lifted up my mood immediately. so I was really glad to read that part of the book.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned that when you stumbled upon this project, part of the reason for you to stick with the project is because of the songs that you were able to find on those CD-ROM. And you also mentioned that you actually found at least a total of 138 songs composed by the Third Karmapa. But in this book, your book is structured in two sections. The first section focuses on a biographical account of his life, from his birth to his education and his retreat, and also leading toward his death. And in the second part of the book, and you included English translations of many of the poems that was composed by him, and many of which has never been translated into English before. So my question for you is, in this book, despite the fact that there are 138 songs and poems composed by the Third Karmapa, you were only able to include the translation of a handful of them. How did you choose and decide which ones to include and which ones to exclude?
So, for my sins, for my bad karma, I guess, I translated all 138 poems with the help of some amazing friends and guidance. I was getting someone going through it with me, Per Tulku, who lives in Sikkim, and he said, "I'll take you through these poems, but you have to be here in his place where he was living at 6 a.m. and it was freezing." So, I had to get up at 6 a.m. and work through some of the poems, but I did manage to get through all of them. And my friend Tenzin Rinpoche Brensana helped me in Australia as well. There is a lot, and I will keep drawing from them. There's at some stage, I think I'll try and work with Shambhala again to do a collection of all of the different Karmapa songs, but I just that will probably have to be in the future a bit. I tried to pick ones that were of types, and not just from his songs, but also from the short pieces from his entire collected works, right? So I'm fascinated by the fact that this man wrote all of these almost like cooking. It's almost like a cookbook for how to live in the mountains. You know, the Julen tradition, and he also retranslated his another big project of his was the past life stories of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, as well as his own life story. So. And he included stories of women in those as well that I thought was really super fascinating. So I tried to pick a bit from all of them, and I also wanted to, because I'd written this book after the other book on reincarnation, and so I'd used some of the poems on specifically on reincarnation in the first book. So I tried to pick ones that weren't part of that the reincarnation story, and we're talking about other things in this book. So it was kind of a poems of a type. Poems that weren't part of the reincarnation story, and kind of ones that had something of a reputation. Like the poem that's about Mahamudra, the aspiration of Mahamudra, is one that gets recited at a lot throughout Karmakagyu monasteries and prayer festivals and so on, all over South Asia and East Asia. So, yeah, I thought that was important to include my version. I feel like it's a cover version, though, because so many people have translated it. So my cover version of that song. But there's other ones that were less well-known. So I was trying to get different types and different representations of different types of songs, and then from different parts of his oeuvre. Is that how you say it? Yeah.
Okay, so since we're already talking about poems and songs composed by the third Gamaba, I'm just wondering, do you have a favorite among the ones that you have translated so far? Would you like, you know, would you mind reading it to us?
So I've got several favorites. There's several favorites. There's one I really like, but it's too long to read. And this actually, there's one poem that changed my life that I should say, because in one way, because it's so amazing. I was working through all these poems, translating one, almost like one every few days. And I got to one, I'd been working on one that was about their Shendong Zhangdong, like external intrinsic emptiness, that it had been part of a lot of philosophical debates within Buddhist studies. And I worked on that and I was like, oh yeah, that was interesting. And I got to the next one, which was about a famine in which people were so desperate that they had sunk to cannibalism. So we went from one to this other, and I knew about the philosophical debate, but this one was so striking and so intensely environmental as well. It was describing all of the different types and economic, and it was so kind of, it was like a protest song, right? So it was like Bob Dylan or something, you know. It was really not so much angry as like calling out people in power. It called out the emperor as the king of thieves, and it was just so like, I don't know. It's like something people would be screaming on the streets. And I was so amazed by it. I was like so struck by the contrast between these two different poems. But they both still sounded like Rangchen Dorji. So that one I loved. And it also got me really interested in environmental history. And that's been the last 5 years since I worked on that project. But there's other ones that are of a type where he's kind of really, he's one of the first Tibetans, or one of the only ones actually until really recently, to talk about life in a city, because he was in Xanadu. So that contrast between his life in the mountains and what it was like living in the city, I found that really amazing. Because I don't know, I know you grew up in a different space, but I grew up with these stories of Xanadu as this mystical city. There's this really famous poem, like In Xanadu by Coleridge, In Xanadu to Kubla Khan. And when I was a really little kid in the 80s, there's this Australian singer called Olivia Newton-John who was in a movie about roller skating called Xanadu, right? So I had all of these images of this mystical place in my head, and he just is like, I hate this place. This place is full of things that are going to mess with you. So that those poems from that, why I don't like Xanadu genre, is all that set. I really like them as well because I find them really good to think about now. So do you want me to read one from the Xanadu set? So you
yes,
wrote
please.
This. but you asked which is a favorite, and that's like choosing between children or something. Goodness. Anyway, but this one, yes, is very much from the ones he wrote in Zendra that I really like. Okay. Now you are free from samsara's mud. Strike out for nirvana's dry shore. Now you have abandoned worldly relatives. Rely on sacred spiritual friends. Now you have stopped pointless chatter. Recite secret mantras. Now you have stopped debauched exertions. Exert yourself at dhyana or meditation. Now you have renounced sweets. Rely on samadhi's food. Now that you have stopped hankering for towns, wander in mountainous borderlands. Because when you don't do these things, external appearances become expert in deception. Children of the mind, they are crazy in the head. Preconceptions proliferate and last longer, but virtuous friends become increasingly rare. Ignorant veils and fogs get thicker, and we wander on multiplying cliffs of depravity. Unwholesome friends lead us to prison, the three bad destinations where we will wander without end. So he's like, help, I need to get out of Xanadu before everything goes bad. Yeah. It's amazing though. I love all the imagery in it, right? It's like, And the idea of sweets, he's always going on about sweets and how he's trying to renounce sweets. It's so kind of, I don't know, relatable.
Is there a particular obsession with sweet treats in Tibetan culture? Because I remember there was like a term like describing, you know, some people as like us, you know, having sweet teas.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I read a lot of poems and I hadn't come across someone who's telling people off for eating sweets as much as Rangjung Dorji. He seems to have a lot of his poems. He talks that he's telling his followers not to get too into sweets. And it wouldn't have been sugar at that point as well. It's like just sweet things. I just found that super fascinating. Yeah.
And since we already talk about Rangjung Dorji's reaction, and, you know, and also his reflection on his experience in Xanadu, I wanted, you know, the next question that I wanted to ask you is not about the content of the book, but instead I'm interested in your decisions on the presentation of the book. You know, this book is based on very specialized research and it requires a full command of the Tibetan language. But you just wrote with such clarity, and I think you have a remarkable storytelling skill. And you began with the book. You began the book with a very short sentence, and I'll quote you: "Rangjung Dorji did not like Xanadu." And when I read that sentence, I immediately began to think, you know, where is Xanadu? Like, what is Rangjung Dorji doing there in Xanadu? Like, why he didn't like it? So, as a reader, it captivated me immediately. It's like, you know, opening the book, about Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, and the first sentence is, where did Papa go with that axe? So your opening sentence to this book had the same effect, as the one, the opening sentence in Charlotte's Web had on me as a reader. I think this is a remarkable accomplishment because it is really challenging and not easy to write for the combination of the public and academic audience. I'm just wondering, like, have you thought about presenting this book in this particular way from the very beginning when you began to work on this project, or it was something that, was gradually developed while you were working on this project? And how did you manage to write a scholarly book so engaging? Earlier, you mentioned that before committing yourself to become a scholar in Asian studies, you worked as a journalist, and I wonder maybe your training as a journalist maybe have something to do with the way you craft and present your stories in the book?
Yeah. Well, first, thanks. That's really nice. Thank you for that. Some of it starts earlier because my dad used to tell stories all the time, and I come from this tradition of storytelling. But also, I think some of them were really boring, my dad's stories, so I kept thinking, how do you tell them better? But as being trained as a journalist, we got taught to write, we got chucked out of the journalism course if we used the wrong it's. And we had exercises, write in the active voice, change the sentence into the active voice all the time, right? There's a lot of training in actual writing. But I actually think in terms of the idea, there's two elements there. There's one thing about learning how to write for a different audience, but then there's something about dealing with complicated stories and philosophical matters in an accessible way. And I learned that by being an interpreter for some very good Tibetan Buddhist teachers, right? And in particular, I would say one man that I translated for, Gyatso Setting, for years, who was a fantastic storyteller and would break down and he would change the pace of the way he was teaching, right? He really thought about the way he was teaching, and he would tell a story and then he'd do a little bit of philosophy and then he'd change it up. And so I think by interpreting for him and for other people, I learned about how you can get these ideas across through stories, because they don't, if you get a whole download of philosophical information, it's pointless. You don't take it in. Stories are an amazing, very human, I think, gift, right, of how to convey this information. So that idea of thinking about how you tell these particular stories that embed this kind of Buddhist philosophy that can be complicated and relies on different understandings of the world came definitely from like Genla, from Geshe-la, and other people that I interpreted for. Yeah. And then in terms of this book, I had this idea in my head of making it very separate from the reincarnation book, which was much more about the tradition. And Ranjan George's linked to the reincarnation tradition, whereas this one, when they approached me, it was his I got approached by Shambhala to write it. It was a focus on his life story and how he lived, and some examples from, combined with some examples from his of translations of his collective works. So yeah, I had a different idea in my head of how to tell the story.
So this book project basically transformed by itself as you were working on it.
Yeah, yeah. But I started off with this idea of how do you tell a story? Yeah, that's kind of, I don't know. I don't want to do books that you can't read. You know what I mean? So I can't see myself doing that kind of ever. Oh, hopefully not. I want to be that. My personal kind of journey is to become a better and better storyteller. Yeah.
And I think it's, precisely for that reason, I had this impression that I can imagine myself, you know, as a traveler, maybe waiting for my flight, or, you know, in a train station, I wanted to spend some time and I can accidentally pick up a book and, you know, have a really good read and enjoying the time that I can spend with
your
book.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad. But more so than that makes me happy, not necessarily because you're like of being able to tell the story. It's like, I kept having this idea that I was thinking about how Ranjan Dorji lived through his stories, yeah, and then trying to make those kind of act as some way of making those stories accessible to people who were reading them in a very different way. And I use this epigraph in the beginning. Is epigraph, is that what you say when you open a book? I've got a mental blank on that term. Where he says at the beginning of his biography, he says, I'm telling you the stories of when I was young. It already feels like someone else's story. And if I write it down, it'll become someone else's story, like as a gift to the other people. And I just love that. That's just, I thought that was really, really great way of thinking about telling stories about one's life. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. You know, Bruce, you've been so generous with your time, and it's such a great pleasure talking to you about, you know, the stories behind the writing of this book. So now this book is published already, and what are some of the new projects that you are working on right now? Would you like to share that with the audience?
Okay, so as I said at one point, this poem about famine set me off on a whole other adventure. And I've, since reading that poem, I've been thinking about Tibetan environmental history, Tibetan and Himalayan environmental history. So I would have finished in my next book, which is going to be a biography of the Yalong Thampor River, which Ranjan Dorji crosses quite a few times. I would have finished that if I hadn't have spent 2 years in what feels like 2 years in lockdown. So I'm just finishing that up as soon as possible. And I've also been, so I've been working on more of the kind of link between sacred geographies and environmental histories of this region, which I feel like Ranjan Dorji introduced me to. And I'm about, after I finish the river project, I'm going to start writing a history of Himalayan ice. And as a side project, I'm really interested, which is kind of more of a kind of a Buddhist-y vibe. I'm really interested in how you approach the understandings of, people keep talking about environmental anxiety or just general anxiety and the grief we've all experienced over the last few years through the pandemic. I'm interested in how we approach those kind of like environmental emotions from within a Buddhist framework or a Buddhist lens. So that's kind of my side, still religious studies project, and the rest of it is more environmental history.
This all sounds like really cool and exciting projects. And I hope we might be able to invite you back for another conversation when your next book is out. So thank you so much again, Ruth. It was a great pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.